Okay. Tov. We left off last week. We began seeing how the Rav speaks about over here, chapter 2, the different outlooks, the different ways of viewing the world, the mystery of the world, of religious man and cognitive man. And he spoke about how the eternal Greek legacy from the time of Plato and Aristotle throughout the generations afterwards has brought about that scientific man and the ongoing focus of cognitive man has been to try to put explanations to the world and to all the phenomena that the world consists of. And when a cognitive man looks at the world, he looks at it with a goal to conquer, to understand, to fathom, to be able to bring order to the world. As opposed to religious man, who wants to emphasize the mystery itself. The religious person, when a religious person looks at the beauty of the world and the grandeur of the world and the majesty of the world, the religious person is not interested in equations. The religious person is not interested in whipping out, you know, calculators and whipping out maps and whipping out, you know, magnifying glasses. The religious person looks at the beauty of the world and looks at the mystery of the world and wants to emphasize that mystery. He gazes at that which is obscure without the intent of explaining it and inquires into that which is concealed without the intent of receiving the reward of clear understanding. Now, I've told you before that Rav Soloveitchik, this is a translation from the Hebrew, right? But those, I mean, even though this over here in English, I'm sure you all understood these words that we just read. We spoke already last week. What's he hinting to? What's he making a play on words when he says that the religious person inquires into that which is concealed without the intent of receiving the reward of clear understanding? Shalei l'shma, right? To do a mitzvah, to serve Hashem, not for the sake of receiving reward, right? It's one of the ultimate goals of a religious person and a religious person's inner life, that the motivation for serving God could sometimes be in order to receive reward, and sometimes could be not for the sake of receiving reward. Now, usually we associate the reward, of course, as reward being the world to come and after death, etc. Here the Rav is referring to the reward of understanding. That the religious person looking at the world, he's not looking for the reward of understanding. He's enjoying the mystery itself. He wants, and then the last words where we left off, the last sentence of the next paragraph, he wants to accept the fascinating eternal mystery that envelops the object. And this is where we left off last time. And I mentioned to you, we spoke about at the end of last week's class, John Keats, the romantic poet, where he speaks about negative capability, the capability of man to hold back the irritating desire to understand things and to revel in the mystery. That irritating, annoying, part of within the human mind that wants to rationalize and contain and put everything in a file cabinet, and to rather revel in the mystery, to enjoy the obscure, to enjoy the mystery. And we read from Heschel about the idea of living in the sight of the depth of the unutterable, and to really come to the first step towards God is being able to enjoy that mystery of the world, of that everything around oneself. But I wanna go a little deeper into it, because really this idea that Rav Soloveitchik is saying over here, he doesn't really explain. In other words, over here in chapter 2, the way chapter 2 is structured, the first half of the chapter he says that the difference between religious and cognitive man is that religious man seeks the mystery, cognitive man seeks to understand. The second half, which we're going to get to next week, the second half of chapter 2, he speaks about religious man's yachas, his relationship to order, to ideas. But he doesn't, and then chapter 3, he goes into a whole new subject. The Rav doesn't really explain why does religious man like the mystery. Why? Why is he fascinated with the mystery? Why is he fascinated with the unknown? Why? So we mentioned last week, really there, in my opinion, there are four explanations. I think there are four ways of explaining why does the religious person, when the religious person, again, as he's going to say, the second half of the chapter, it doesn't mean that a religious person can't be a scientist. It doesn't mean that religious men, though one has the temperament of religious man, it doesn't mean that you can't understand scientific equations. It doesn't mean that you can't understand the biological explanations of things going on in the world. That's not what he's saying. We've mentioned many times that even though the Rav mentions he keeps differentiating between religious man and cognitive man, it doesn't mean that they can't both be the same person. There are different aspects of the personality. Part of being a rich person is being able to harmonize different aspects of the psyche. One could have the psyche of a cognitive man and the psyche of a religious man, depending on what you're doing at that particular time. But he doesn't really explain why is it? Why is the religious person, why is the part of the temperament, why does a religious person need the temperament of a romantic poet? Why does a religious person need to see the mystery of creation and childbirth and the way the world works and to glorify that the mystery of, as Heschel spoke about, the sense of the ineffable? Why? Why is that? So we mentioned last week, I think there are four explanations. The first one we already mentioned last week, and that is that religious person is seeking for hints of God. The religious person looks at the world and wants to see the footprints in the sand. The religious person is looking at the world and wants to sense God. He wants to sense the higher power. From the time of Abraham, that Abraham looked at the world and was overcome with that sense of wonder, that sense of radical amazement, that sense of feeling that Yesh Balabais Labirazu, there must be a master to this house. What in the world speaks, hints, screams that there is a master to the house? What is that sign? It is that mystery. It is that wonder. It is the fact that we really can't explain things. And it is the fact that we're overcome with this amazement at looking at things in this world. And again, it doesn't have to be, it could be a beautiful sunset, and it could be glorious mountains, but could also be mundane things like the smile of your child. It could be things like the tuna fish sandwich that you had for lunch. And you see things then, and like we spoke, remember Heschel mentioned last week, it could be a table, it could be a piece of paper, it could be anything. But to be amazed at it, at the wonder that's in everything. And that speaks of God. That conveys God's presence. Do you know that the Zohar, the most important book of the Kabbalah, the Zohar begins with a verse from Yeshaya, a pasuk from Yeshaya, a verse from Isaiah. It's a verse from Isaiah chapter 60, which many of you know as Nachmu Nachmu Ami, right? Nachmu happens to be my bar mitzvah parsha. Nachmu Nachmu Ami, yours also?
Chapter 40.
It's chapter 40? It's not Samach something? Okay, I'll take your word for it. The Samachs are usually, the end of the 60s are usually the ones with the consolation phrases, but you'll check in your iPhone. So over there, Nachmu Nachmu Ami, when Isaiah comforts us, comfort the nation, there's a verse over there that the Pasuk says like this. It's 40? Su'u mar meneichem u'u mi bara eila. Su'u mar meneichem u'u mi bara eila. What does that mean? Raise up your eyes to the heavens. Su'u mar meneichem. Pick up your eyes, raise up your eyes to the heavens. U'u and see mi bara eila. And see who created everything. Su'u, listen to the words. Su'u mar meneichem. Pick up your eyes to the heavens. Uru mi bar Eila, and see who created Eila, everything. And the Zohar teaches that these words, mi and Eila, listen to the Hebrew words. Su'u mar menechem, pick up your eyes to the heavens. Uru and see mi bara Eila. Mi means who? Created Eila. What's Eila? All of this. All of this, all of the world. That's Eila. But the Zohar teaches that the word mi is referring to a higher level of God's infinite light. Mi. Mi means who? Who? Who is it? That's me. Eile means this. Me and Eile are opposites, right? Me and Eile are opposites. Me is saying who? Eile is saying this. So by saying mi bara Eile, who's the one that created this? This being empirical reality. And the Zohar says that when one looks at the Eila, when one looks and focuses on the Eila, on the empirical reality that you experience, you're supposed to raise up your eyes, sumar meneichem, or u and see me. Who is the one? The me. The who. The transcendent mysterium tremendum in Latin. The tremendous mystery, that infinite light of Hashem. The me, the one. Who is that one? This mysterious God that created all of this. Mi bara Eila. Now you all understand that if you take the letters of the word mi and the word Eila, it spells the name Elokim. It spells the name of God Elokim. Elokim, the name of Hashem Elokim, is made up of Eila and mi. Elohim is Hashem's name that means concealment. It's the name that conceals Hashem. And we have to, so to speak, take apart the Elohim. We have to disengage. We have to take apart the Elohim to become the me bara Eila, the me that created the Eila. And that's why Se'u Marim Enechem, it says in Chassidus, Se'u Marim Enechem Rosh Tevas Shema. If you take the first letters of the word Su Marim Enechem, the first letters of the word Su Marim Enechem, pick up your eye, Su Marim Enechem is Shin Mem Ayin, spell Shema. That's the Shema. Shema, you understand that being a religious Jew is not just saying it twice a day. We close our eyes and say the Shema twice a day, but that's only when you're supposed to say it orally, twice or three times a day. The Shema is supposed to be an all-day constant aspect of connecting to God. One is supposed to always be saying the Shema. The Shema is Sumar Menechem. You don't have to close your eyes. When you pick your eyes up and look at the heavens, that's saying the Shema. When you pick your eyes up and see the heavens, when you see the mystery of the heavens, and the mystery of the heavens is not necessarily picking your eyes up, you understand, doesn't mean necessarily lifting up your eyes geographically towards the sky, even though of course it means that. Do you understand that Sumar Menechem, picking up your eyes to the heavens, could be when you're looking at your children's face? Sumar Menechem could be when you're looking at the tuna fish sandwich on your plate. There's Sumar Menechem. There are two different ways of looking at the world around you. There's looking at the world around you and picking up your eyes. That means looking into the deeper thing of what you're experiencing. That's the me, bara Eila. Who is the one, this higher being that created all of this? The mystery of the world speaks of that me that created the Eila. That's how you take apart the Elohim. There's a beautiful sentence. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the book Hayom Yom, which is a book in the book that the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, different sayings, a collection of different sayings of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rayatz. So from the 13th of Shvat is my favorite saying over there. It's one of the deepest sayings ever. He brings actually from the Tzemach Tzedek. In my opinion, it's one of the most deepest sentences ever uttered, and it's something that one could live with all the time. The Tzemach Tzedek said like this: how great is the kindness of God that He created man to walk erect on 2 feet, not like an animal that walks on 4, because now man could see the sky. How great is man that now he walks on 2 feet as opposed to an animal that walks on 4 because now he could see the sky. The difference between a man and an animal is if you're seeing the sky. Now you understand that doesn't just mean to actually see the sky, the physical sky, even though that's true also. It says in the Sfarim that it's a segula for your shemaim to look at the sky. It does say in the holy books that it arouses the fear of heaven if one actually looks at the sky. But it doesn't just mean that. Looking at the sky means how you look at the world around you. Are you looking at the sky? Or are you looking at just the me that's bar Eila, or just the Elohim? How many times could a man look up before he sees the sky? Right? How many times could a man look up before he sees the sky? There are people that could look at the world for years and years and years and be quote unquote Orthodox Jews and never see the sky. And never see the sky. Looking at the world and seeing the sky means seeing the me, bara Eila, seeing that mystery, that beauty, that grandeur in the world, to see Hashem that's in the world. That comes from, as Rav Soloveitchik is saying, gazing at that which is obscure without the intent of explaining it. Gazing at that which is obscure without the intent of explaining it. I don't want to just know about chromosomes and cells and molecules and stuff. I don't want to know just know about electromagnetic fields. There's a place for that too. But I want to know the me that's bara Eila. I want to see the sky. I want to read to you from a very beautiful book called The World Within. An author from the beginning of the 20th century. His name was Rufus Jones. Actually, he was a Quaker, but he's a very deep, very profound thinker. And he writes a couple of paragraphs over here, and especially when he brings it down, he's going to bring a anecdote from Robert Louis Stevenson. You all remember good old from Treasure Island. But he brings over here a quote from this idea over here, which really touched me when I read it. And I think it very much speaks about this idea that Rav Soloveitchik that was speaking about, the mystery that brings about, that points to the sky. Listen. This again was the beginning of the 20th century. We know much more about the universe than the ancient world knew. But the more we know about it, the harder it becomes for our spirits to accept the visible universe as the ultimate and final reality. The more we know about it, listen again, we know more about the universe than ancients, but the more we know about it, the harder it becomes for our spirits to accept the visible universe as the ultimate and final reality. The cold and pitiless forces of nature are not less cold and pitiless when we succeed in discovering their laws and habits. One comes back from his study of the march of suns and planets and the spiral movements of the world, making nebulae with very little to comfort the longings of the heart. He sees that these curves are all irrevocable and inevitable, and that each event unfolds out of the one which preceded it. It is a wonderful and amazing system that the scientific research has brought about to explain. But it offers no tenderness, no love, no balm for the wounds of the spirit. It rolls mercilessly on, and he may be thankful if its wheels do not ride over him, the midget of an hour, riding on one of the flying globes of this mechanical system. It is useless to expect tenderness and love and balm in a system of mechanical forces. That kind of world can reveal gravitation and electricity, attraction and repulsion. It can show us matter moving under law. It can exhibit the transformation of one form of energy into some other form. But from the nature of the case, it cannot manifest a heart of tenderness or a spirit of love. Those traits belong only to a person, and a mechanical system can never reveal a person. If religion is, as I profoundly believe, the essential way to the full realization of life, by the way, how many of us could say that? That religion is the essential way to the full realization of life. Sometimes we look at religion as just a burden, right? Sometimes religion is just a pain in the neck. Religion is the essential, if we believe that the religion is the essential way to the full realization of life, we, who claim to know about it, ought to interpret it so that its meaning stands out plain and clear to those who need it most to live by. I have always believed and maintained that the apparent lack of popular interest in religion is largely due to the awkward and blundering way in which it has been presented to the mind and heart of those who all the time carry deep within themselves inner hungers and thirsts which nothing but God can satisfy. I do not want to write or print a line which does not at least bar the mark and seal of reality, and which will not make some genuine fact of life more plain and sure. The struggle for a conquering inner faith has in these strenuous days been laid upon us all. The easy inherited secondhand faith, in other words, secondhand faith means what I inherited from my parents. Those people that they got religion, you know, as a Yerusha, as an inheritance. The easy secondhand faith will not do for any of us now. We cannot stand the stern issues of life and death with any feeble formal creed. We demand something real enough and deep enough to answer the human cry of our soul today. We need to be assured that we do not in last resort fall back on the play of molecules, but that underneath us are everlasting arms. We want to know not only that there is law and order, but that a genuine heart of love touches our heart and brings us calm and confidence. Robert Louis Stevenson has somewhere told of an experience that happened once to his grandfather. He was on a ship that was caught by a terrific storm and was carried irresistibly toward a rocky shore where complete destruction was imminent. When the storm and danger were at the height, he crept on the deck to look around and face the worst. Suddenly he saw the pilot lashed to the wheel, with all his might and nerve holding the vessel off the rocks and steering it inch by inch into safer water. While he stood watching, the pilot looked up at him and smiled. It was little enough, but it completely reassured him. He went back to his room below with new confidence, saying to himself, "We shall come through. I saw the pilot smile." If we could only in some way catch sight of a smile on the face of the great pilot in the strange rough sea in which we are sailing, we too could do our work and carry our burdens with confidence, perhaps with joy. That's the mystery that the world conveys. The mystery, religious person looks at the world and he wants to see the pilot smiling. He wants to see the pilot smiling that we're getting where we need to go, inch by inch into safer waters. That's one reason why the religious person looks at the mystery and wants to emphasize it. But there's a second reason which I believe is deeper. I think there's another reason that the religious person looks at the world and wants to emphasize the mystery and the grandeur and the wonder and the amazement. Because the religious person is comfortable, and not just comfortable, but wants to live with the unknown. Cognitive man is afraid to live in the face of the unknown. Anyone that studied any psychology knows that there are few things as scary as facing that abyss known as the unknown. Putting order to things is a refuge from chaos. The world has such chaos to it, and there's so many things happening that are so unnerving and unsettling. One of the methods that man uses to try to bring calm and reassurance is to put labels. Labels are, on one hand, you know, it's a two-edged sword, labels. Putting labels and categorizing, on one hand, is very assuring. It builds self-confidence, but on the other hand, it's very dangerous. It's a tool that human beings use to solve the impossible complexity of the environment that faces them, but what could very often happen is that it backlashes. Because when putting labels on things, remember we spoke about last week with the Greeks when there are many gods, because they needed to, 2 weeks ago, they needed to put labels on the different forces of nature. Labels assures a person. You're not facing the unknown anymore. You could define it now. But the danger of it is that you end up losing out a lot. You lose out on really enjoying the multiplicity. When you label, when you put labels on things, you miss out on the multiplicity of things. And there's beauty in multiplicity and versatility. I read someplace an article a while ago. It was speaking about the danger of labeling. You're speaking it from a psychological perspective. But first, the author of this article wrote a very fascinating thing. Maybe Reuven will be able to tell me out, or Myra. In Russian, there are two words for blue. One for light blue and one for dark blue. There are two words, I would not remember how to say it, but there are two distinct words for blue. One for dark blue, one for light blue. Right, that was it. One with a G, one with an S. I remember that, right. So, and in English, we just say blue. So psychologists did a study, and they showed how people that speak Russian had a much easier time to be able to differentiate between different shades of blue. They right away were able to differentiate. They differentiated right away between different shades of blue. Why? Because they were able. They had. It wasn't just all lumped together as blue. Because they had in their mind, in their language, in their labeling, different words. So they were able to pick up with their eyes visually to actually see the different shades of blue much quicker. Psychologically, as soon as you label and you lump things together, you miss out on details. I don't need to tell you, I'm sure you all know, it's a very sad fact, but from, you know, somebody sent me a cartoon a couple months ago, an email, that you see a couple of Hasidim, you know, I guess it was Chol HaMoed or something, a couple of Hasidim standing by the penguin cage. So you see a couple of Hasidim all wearing, you know, black and white, like my mother says about me, they always dress up like a newspaper. You see a couple of Hasidim, you know, standing by the penguin cage, and then you see one penguin saying to the other, How do they tell each other apart? How are they able to tell each other apart? The one penguin says the other one, how could they all look the same? How are they able to tell each other apart? So you understand that recognition comes from, distinction comes from being acquainted with something. Being able to differentiate become when you're able to, when you're acquainted with something, you could differentiate. But if you're not acquainted well enough, then everything looks the same. It's very sad, but it's true that for people, some people, you go to certain countries, and all the people in that country look the same, right? All their faces look the same because there's something that's not like me. When it's not you, it's very easy to label them. These people are Jewish. These people are Chinese. These people are Arab. So you label them, and then all of a sudden, all the distinctions go away. psychologically it's very scary, because what ends up happening to people is that once you get a label, once you get labeled somehow, you know, the class is labeled, these are the weaker students and these are the stronger students. Right? So you label them as the weaker student, you've essentially declared that he's going to spend the next decades of his life as a weaker person. And this happens all the time. These are the rich people, these are the poor people. You already declared that you're in the poor person, so automatically you don't strive to achieve as much financially. Psychologically, being labeling is very dangerous. But why do we do it? We do it because we're not comfortable with the unknown. The chaos of the world is very unnerving, so we try to put labels on things. The saddest part is when it happens with religion. It's the story of most of the wars of all the centuries is when one religion labeled another religion. It's all labels. And within Judaism, I don't need to tell you. This is this label and that label and that label. Everyone has different labels. And then all of a sudden, that's it. I can have nothing to do with this person because he's not the same label as I have. So you fail to see the beauty in the distinctions. A harmony is not just one sound. It's a lot of different sounds putting together. That's what a harmony is. And also what ends up happening is that people get comfortable with labels. It's not just, it's you and the, I'm labeled, I'm religious. I have a label on my forehead, I'm a religious Jew. I'm Orthodox. So I could stay in my comfort zone. So I'm okay, safe, you know, gliding along my life, because I have a label, I'm religious, I'm Orthodox Jew, you know, and I feel myself blah, blah, blah. And therefore, since I'm an Orthodox religious person, I don't need to strive to get closer to God. I don't need to always be trying to get out of my comfort zone because I'm in a box. I'm in a religious. I have a label. I'm okay. I'm religious. I'm going to go to the world to come because I'm Orthodox. I write it on my form, you know, my application form that I'm an Orthodox Jew. So I'm going to the world to come. Doesn't matter how I act because I have that label. Labels are dangerous. Labels take away vitality. Labels take away the possibility of growth, the possibility of really being able to suck out the marrow of the details of what the world is all about. And therefore you understand that a truly religious person, Rav Soloveitchik is saying, is not looking to label. A truly religious person is okay with the mystery. A truly religious person is okay with the obscure, with not being able to define, with not being able to label, with not being able to declare and put things in cute little neat boxes. The religious person is not looking to put God in a little box like a little pet dog. And the religious person is not looking to be able to put the world in a little box and in a file cabinet. The religious person is comfortable with standing by the unknown. Many people go through life being afraid to venture out because they're afraid of the unknown, right? I remember Rebbe by a bar mitzvah. I actually remember whose bar mitzvah it was, but I won't say. But Rebbe, it was many years ago already, Rebbe spoke by a bar mitzvah. And the bar mitzvah was in Nisan, the month of Nisan, right before Pesach. So he spoke about that in the Haggadah. In the Haggadah, you remember the part of the Haggadah that says the words that when we start telling the story of the Exodus by the Seder, so the words that we begin telling the children the story of the Exodus, what are the two words we begin the story with? Tzei ulmad. Say ulmad ma bikesh Lavan harami lasas liyakav avinu. Go out and learn what Laban, what Lavan wanted to do to Jacob, right? Say ulmad, go out and learn. So the Rebbe spoke about that. You remember from Peanuts, you know, from Snoopy, Linus had his cute little blanket. Remember that? You remember Linus from Peanuts, that he had the little security blanket? It's from Snoopy, yeah, Linus was his name, right? So there are people that spend their whole life under a security blanket. They don't want to face the unknown. They don't want to strive to discover and to explore because it's unknown. It's scary. And Tzei ulmad means that you're being told, go out, explore new things. Be able to face the unknown. I want to tell you, I thought of an idea. I don't know if it's true or not, but you all know the Chazal teach. Chazal say that Loi nitna Torah ela la'oichlei haman. Chazal, the Gemara says that the Torah was given only to the generation that ate the man, the manna from heaven. Torah was given to a generation that was eating the manna from heaven. Now you understand that when Chazal are saying it, they don't just mean nana, they got the Torah and we can't get the Torah. Chazal mean to say that if you want to be a person that what? that acquires Torah, you have to start eating manna from heaven. You have to be oichle haman. To get Torah, you need to be oichle haman. You need to be able to eat man. I remember I was once, when I was in South Shore, Rabbi Katzenstein, you know Rabbi Katzenstein from Woodmere, so he once was giving a Musar Shmuz. Rabbi Katzenstein was saying, it was a very life-altering speech, where he said that to really achieve Torah, you have to be willing to face the unknown and being able to say, yes, I'm willing to make sacrifices for God, for religion, to acquire Torah. I might not know, I don't know if it's politically incorrect. So what I'm about to say now, I'm putting, you know, labels that if this offends you, then don't listen to it, okay? I'm just telling you what he said. You don't have to accept it, whatever. I'm just telling you what he said. He was giving Musar Shmuz against college. Okay, that's what he was speaking about. He was speaking against college, and he was saying that if you agree with it, don't agree with it, I'm not going to tell you what I believe. It doesn't matter. I'm just saying what his point was, that if you want to acquire Torah, you have to be oichle haman. You have to be willing to take that leap of faith to eat manna from heaven. You have to be oichle haman. Again, it applies to all of us every day. Because what Chazal are trying to say, is that to acquire Torah, you have to have faith in God. You have to know that He's the one that's bringing sustenance. You have to have faith in Hashem. That's how that Chazal is usually explained. That Oichle Haman, the reason that you need to be Oichle Haman to be able to receive Torah, is because you need to have that faith in God, to know that your man is coming from heaven. There's another explanation. That's one explanation why you have to be an Oichle Haman. There's another explanation, another famous one, that is, why do you have to be Oichle Haman? Not just because you have to have that faith in God, but why else? Because you can't be preoccupied. That's the simple explanation. You can't be preoccupied with worldly matters. A person that's always preoccupied with seeking the material and seeking to have a bigger bank account and more material possessions, you're not going to be able to really get close to God. You have to be able to focus on God in one's life, and that includes curbing that innate desire to always be having more and more material possessions. So you can't be preoccupied. But I thought to myself another explanation. Again, take it or leave it. But I think one of the ideas that in order to have a connection to God, you have to be oichle haman, is because part of having a deep connection to God means being okay, relying on Him, living with the unknown, facing the abyss of the unknown, and not having security of what tomorrow brings. Because that's the deepest connection that one could have with God. I want to tell you a teaching from the Ishbitzer. And I think with this teaching, the Ishbitzer is really how to explain this Chazal. There's a beautiful teaching of the Ishbitzer, the Meshiloyach. The Ishbitzer is speaking about, he actually speaks about the fact that if you know in Deuteronomy, in Parshas Ekev, I'm afraid already to say what chapter because David's going to correct me. But I think it's Deuteronomy 8. In Parshas Ekev over there, so the Torah speaks about how the fact that Eretz Asher Tish Demoin, that Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, is a land that lives on rain. Its sustenance is based on rain. The survival of the land of Israel is based on rain. Anyone that learned Maseches Tainus, you learned in the Talmud and Tainus, so you know that it's a whole Masecht about rain. If you lived in Israel, you also know rain is a mamash problem in Israel. Their whole agriculture is based on rain. As opposed to what? As opposed to the land of Egypt, that Egypt was always the most wealthy empire throughout history. Egypt was a prize that all the emperors wanted. Why was Egypt always so wealthy? Why did Egypt always have such a bounty? Because they lived from the Nile. They didn't need rain. They had very complex irrigation systems from the Nile. They didn't need rain. So the Ishbitzer asks a very simple question. Asks the Ishbitzer, Egypt, in biblical terms, is like, that's like the code word like for like, you know, the bastion of sin. It's like, you know, it's like saying Las Vegas or something, right? Egypt is like Las Vegas, I don't know, Greenwich Village, or, you know, whatever you want to say, yeah? Trafalgar Square, whatever. Egypt was like Ervas Haaretz, Ervas Mitzrayim. Egypt is the code word for the place of impurity. And Israel is the Holy Land. Ask the Ishbitzer, how does it make sense to say that Eretz Yisrael, the Holy Land, which is God's land, which is the place that He gave to the Jewish people, we, in order to survive, we have to always worry about rain. It's always a problem. We have to worry about having rain all the time. We have to pray for it. It's a whole issue. Egypt, which is the bastion of sin, right? Egypt, which is considered the code word for the place that is not aware of God, Egypt always has money. Always has money, always has water, never has issues. So the Ishbitzer says, listen to this, says the Ishbitzer, you could ask the exact same question. When we go back to the Garden of Eden, Genesis chapter 3, when we go back to original sin, and God meted out punishments to Adam and to even to the snake. Adam got a really bad punishment, right? Adam, the sweat of your brow, you have to earn bread. Adam was punished with having to get up every morning, get on the Long Island Railroad, and go into the city, put on a suit and tie. That's a bad punishment, having to put on a suit and tie every day. That's what Adam was punished with, right? The sweat of your brow, you have to earn a living. Income taxes and mortgages and balancing checkbooks and whatever. Everyone's already, krechzing, right? That was a pretty bad punishment. Eve was punished with the pain of childbirth, which I've heard is pretty bad. I've heard in more ways than one. What was the punishment of the snake in the Torah? The snake is punished. You're always going to eat dirt. You're going to eat dust. You're going to eat dust. The snake was punished with perpetual room service. The snake was punished with perpetual room service. The snake was punished that you'll always have food. You're going to eat dirt. What's the big punishment here? That he's not going to be able to eat pizza and ice cream? I mean, it's a big punishment. I can hear that. He can have a steak or something. But I guess they get used to it, right? The snake is punished with what? That the snake is going to, wherever you're going to be, you're going to have food. You're going to eat dirt. What's the big punishment over here? The Ishbitzer says, Mamash, it's like, just like Egypt, that Egypt will always have water. So Ishbitzer says a beautiful thing. I'll give you a mashal, I'll give a parable to what the Ishbitzer is saying. Imagine a woman goes to her husband and says, you know, Frank, it's been a long time since we went out to eat together. I really like to go out to eat. So he says to her, you know, you're right, here's $100, go out with one of your girlfriends. And then, a couple of weeks later, she goes to her husband and says, Frank, summer is coming. And, I can't wear the same clothing I wore last summer, which I never understood why, but for some reason, women have to change their wardrobes, annually, a couple of times. I have to get new clothing for the summer. Maybe we could go shopping. So he says, here's a credit card. Go ahead, go buy what you want. And then, a couple of weeks later, it's, the anniversary, and she comes and says, Frank, anniversary's coming up. You've promised me for a long time that I'd like to get a ring. Maybe we could go shopping for a ring. So he says, right, you're right, 100% right. I promised you a ring. Here's a blank check. Go buy yourself a ring. Why is this guy an idiot? Why is this guy an idiot? He's missing these understandings. She's not looking for a restaurant or for clothing or for a ring. She's looking for him. She's not looking for a blank check. She's looking for him. You know what God says to the snake? God is saying to the snake, here's a blank check. You don't need me in your life. In Israel, we have to be raising our eyes to God for rain. We live with the unknown. We live with that uncertainty. We live with that mystery. We live with not having everything clear. We live with not knowing what tomorrow is going to bring. God doesn't give us a blank check. The snake, he says, here, you have a blank check. You don't need me in your life. You don't need to pray. He says to Egypt, here's all the money that you need. Here, land of Egypt. You don't need to pray. You don't need to pick your eyes up to the sky. You're fine. Here's all the money you need. A blank check. To acquire Torah, you have to eat manna from heaven, means you have to lift up your eyes to Hashem and live with that unknown. God does want us to have that relationship with Him. The land of Israel has to be relying on rain. Hashem doesn't want to give us the blank check. He wants us to be able to revel. What do you think is we have to daven every day for food? Three times a day we have to daven, we have to pray for food. Right, and the Gemara's and the spook that really the Kabbalistic books teach that every day God judges what food you're gonna have for that day. How that fits with the fact that on Rosh Hashanah you're judged for the whole year, that's explained in the Svarim, we're not gonna get into it. But every day there's an individual judgment what food you're gonna have, and you have to pray every day for food. Or you could be a person that goes through life, I have security. What's everyone looking for in America? Tonight is the State of the Union address, right? What's in everyone's mind? Security. Everyone wants security. I want economic security. I want military security. I want to be stable. I want security. People by the time they're 25, they already want to know the money they're going to have to retire with. I want my white picket fence. I want a bank account. I want security. I want to know exactly where I'm headed. I don't want any. I want a blank check. I want security. And the Torah says, and again, it doesn't mean that one has to be poor, God forbid. One could be poor and one could have very big bank account, and God should give everyone huge bank accounts with surpluses, mitzvah shem, and only good things. It doesn't mean one could have a lot of money. That's not the point. But the point is that one has to feel that one has to pick one's eyes up to Hashem all the time. I have to daven for my food even if I have $1 million in my bank account. I have to pray to God and know that Hashem wants that relationship. He wants us to rely on Him. But then I think we could go to a third step, a deeper explanation why a religious person lives with the mystery. Let's go a step deeper, a third explanation. You all know this week's parsha, Mamash connects to this week's parsha, Parsha's Truma. This week we're beginning to build the Mishkan. We're building the tabernacle. And everyone knows that the tabernacle, the Mishkan, corresponds to every single Jew making themselves into a tabernacle for God, right? We all have to become tabernacles, we all have to become sanctuaries for God. Hashem wants to dwell within our hearts, within our bodies. And therefore, we know that Chassidus teaches that whatever it says about the Mishkan corresponds to us also. So now, if I were to ask you, the structure of the Mishkan, the structure of the tabernacle, what held up the Mishkan primarily? This week's parsha, what was the main thing that held up the structure of the Mishkan? What was it? What would you say? Atzei shitim oimdim. Wood, pieces of wood, beams that were standing up. But the Torah says that they have to be beams of wood, atzei shitim oimdim. Standing pieces of wood, oimdim, atzei shitim oimdim. They have to be standing pieces of wood. The Alter Rebbe says in Likutei Torah, Parshas Nosay, an unbelievable idea. Listen carefully. The Alter Rebbe says, what does it mean that the Mishkan is held up, that the main structure of the Mishkan is held up by atzei shitim oimdim, that the Torah stresses that they have to be oimdim? Says the Alter Rebbe, the Gemara in Sota Daf Lamed Tes says, "Ein amida ela shtika." Standing, the Gemara says, standing is silence. Silence is what holds up the structure of the Mishkan. The first step of the Mishkan has to be oimdim, silence. Says the Alter Rebbe, why? Says that you know who else are known as the oimdim. The oimdim, we say every day in davening in the morning, listen carefully, in the morning every day in davening, who do we refer to as oimdim? The malachim, the angels, the seraphim. The seraphim, those angels, the seraphim are oimdim. Oimdim berum oilam. Right? Oimdim berum oilam umashmiim, what's the next word? Biyira, with yira. With yira, which yira is usually translated as fear of God, which we're going to speak about in a second, that's a mistranslation. But yira, the Srafim are oimdim biyira. Amida means silence, means yira. And you understand that before we say the Shema, says the Alter Rebbe, before we say the Shema, now saying the Shema, what emotion is one supposed to have when saying the Shema? Which emotion are you supposed to have? Ahava. Ve'ahavtes Hashem Elokecha. We have to love God. Says the Alter Rebbe, ahava is the structure of the Mishkan. That's the heart. What holds up the ahava, what holds up that love, is the oimdim, is the atzei shitim oimdim, is the silence of yira, the silence that yira brings. What is this silence that yira brings? Now, first of all, yira is not fear of God. One is not, when we say in English, we translate yira as fear of God, people usually have the connotation of being afraid. The Torah does not say to be afraid of God. He's not the big bad wolf. God is not the big bad wolf. Yira is not fear of God. Yira should be translated always as awe. A-W-E, awe, awe. Awe means to be overcome with the majesty and the splendor of God. That silence, that amida, that shtika comes from being overcome. It's like anyone that saw unbelievably beautiful nature, you go to Niagara Falls, you go to the Grand Canyon. Well, you could see even a human structure. You go to Paris and you see some of the architecture on the buildings over there. You can't talk. You're overcome. You're completely overcome. You're bottled. You're nullified by the majesty, the beauty of what you're seeing. You lose yourself. In Yiddish, mazak mifalirt zich. In Yiddish, there's a phrase when you want to say to be have yiras Hashem, falir zich for the Eibishter. You lose yourself in God. to lose oneself. Ahava, love, means to be propelled towards God. Yira means to be overcome by His greatness. And the Yira is the Yesod, that Amida, that Bittel, that Amida, that standing, that silence is what holds up the Mishkan. What the way Chassidus says, Chassidus explains like this, a beautiful idea. The Alter Rebbe goes on to say like this. You remember that Eliezer, when Eliezer, the slave of Avraham, went to make a shidduch for Yitzchak, right? Avraham sent Eliezer to bring Yitzchak and Rivka together. He sent them on a mission to make the first shidduch, the first marriage in the Torah. He sent Eliezer to put together Yitzchak and Rivka. One of the most mysterious verses in the Torah over there in Bereishis, when Eliezer comes and Eliezer tells Rivka to go, you know, to go give the camels to drink, and she goes to give the camels to drink. And then the Torah says a very interesting pasuk. Listen carefully, because the Alter Rebbe says that this pasuk we're supposed to do every single day by davening. This pasuk is halacha lemaisa. We're supposed to be doing this every single day by davening the following pasuk. V'ha'ish mishto'ela machrish ladas. Ha'itzlich Hashem drachav imloi. V'ha'ish mishto'ela, and the man was amazed by her. Machrish was silent, ladas, and thereby came to das, to knowledge. So the Alter Rebbe says that that's two stages called, now what was it to do with Eliezer? Yitzhak and Rivka, you know, represent, Yitzhak is the holiness and Rivka was in the place of impurity. It means being able to unite the higher and the lower, being able to unite the masculine and the feminine, being able to unite the highest levels with the world, being able to unite God's infinite light with this world. You have, meaning davening, that's what prayer is supposed to be. You have to go through these two steps of Va'ish mishto'ela, to be amazed, and then machrish, and then silent. Amazement, and then silence. The Alter Rebbe brings, there's a pasuk in Daniel. In the book of Daniel, chapter 11, it says that Daniel was shown a very, very profound vision. And then it says over there, you know, Daniel is written in Aramaic. And Daniel, it says, Ishtoimim kishochada. Ishtoimim kishochada means he was perplexed, he was amazed. He was dumbfounded. Hishtoimimus. He was amazed. The Alter Rebbe says, do you know what the word hishtoimimus in Hebrew, you know what it relates to? What other word? Shmamoin. What does shmamoin mean? Destruction. Hishtoimimus means destruction. Amazement, in the word in Hebrew for amazement and destruction are the same. Amazement and destruction, which we'll explain in a second. Amazement / destruction. That's step one. Then what's the next step? Silence. Aish mishtoela, shmamein. Then machrish, then silence. So the Alter Rebbe explains like this. When you want one thing to be included in something else, when you want A to become included in B, two things need to happen. A has to first stop being A, then it could become part of B. When you plant a seed in the ground, the seed has to first decompose, then it could be absorbed into the power of the ground to make things grow. Right? When a student wants to receive from a teacher, the student has to first lose his personality, go out of who you were, go out of what you were thinking, and allow yourself to be included in the mind of the teacher. Shmamoin means the first step is yira. The first step is being amazed by God, being amazed by His glory, and thereby going out of yourself. You can't come to love God. Loving God is already that silence. Loving God is becoming included within God. But before you could become included within God, before it could become included part of the ground, you have to first stop being a seed. So therefore, the Alter Rebbe says, you first have to have amida, like the seraphim. Our oimdim brum oilam, the first part of davening, is to come to that amida, that standing, that silence. How do you come to that silence? You have to first stop, you have to have that yira, to be overcome by Hashem's majesty. Lose oneself, then one could become included in the infinite light of Hashem. That's what davening is supposed to be. By Shema, by Shemona Esrei, by those parts of davening, one is supposed to see oneself as being included in God's infinite light. But the first step to be able to do that is, I have to stop being a seed. I have to go out of who I was. That's the shmumming, that's that silence. And therefore you understand, that's the idea that religious man, when a religious man sees the mystery of the world, religious man sees that mystery of the world, he loves it. Why? Because it allows you to go out of yourself. to lose oneself. It's the mystery in creation. It's that transcendent enigma that creation is that allows you to lose yourself, that feeling of loss of self. Do you understand that when you categorize things, that scientific man wants to hold on very tightly to being able to keep his feet on the ground? And religious person wants the opposite. Religious person, I don't want to keep my feet on the ground. I want to lose myself within God. I want to lose myself within God. I want that shmama and I want that destruction. I want that silence. That's how I build the Mishkan. That silence that allows me to go out of who I was until now and become part of Hashem. And then one last fourth thing. And here we have to go to Reb Nachman. A fourth explanation, I think. Reb Nachman of Breslov has a Torah, the 12th Torah in the second part of the Kutei Moran. It's one of the most beautiful ideas ever. Reb Nachman says that very often in our lives we're seeking God and we're frustrated with the lack of feeling God's presence. And we're frustrated with all sorts of things in our lives that sort of conceal God and make that we feel like we can't find Him. And we're not able to tap into His presence. And Reb Nachman says that we then ask, Aye Mokum Kvodo. Aye Mokum Kvodo. Where is the place of His glory? Aye Mokum Kvodo. Where is the place of His glory? So Reb Nachman says, you know what the answer is? The answer to that question is just to change the punctuation at the end of those three words from a question mark to an exclamation point. Aye mokum kvodo. Aye kama mokum kvodo. Where? That is the place of His glory. Aye, when you're asking, where is God? I don't feel Him. Mokum kvodai. That is where God is. He's in that question. He's in that frustration. That means that you're tapping into Him. Aye, mokum kvodai. Where is God? Aye, where is He? Mokum kvodai. That is the place of His glory. If you're having that frustration, that shows you that you're tapping into His presence. Reb Nachman says, the way Reb Nachman says that that's the deeper meaning. You remember when Isaac was being taken by Abraham to the binding, to the Akedah. Avram was taking his son to kill him. And they're about to go up in the mountain. And what does Yitzchak say to Avram? Aye hasel ola. Where is the ram? Where is the offering? So Reb Nachman says that the deeper meaning of those words is Aye. Asking where is God is hasel ola. That is the deepest offering that one could bring to God. Feeling that frustration enough and being frustrated by not feeling Hashem, that means you're tapping into Hashem. Now, Reb Nachman, in the classic Reb Nachman Breslov way, does not explain why. He doesn't explain, he just says, you know, Breslov is emuna. Breslov says to you the truth that Aye is Keser, Aye is Makom Kvodei. When you ask, where is God? That is Makom Kvodei. But in Chabad, in the writings of Chabad, it's explained why that is. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zecherno Livracha, he explains not necessarily about seeking God, the same idea about constantly yearning to grow. He said, listen what he says. It's actually a sicha that I saw was a Tu B'Shvat sicha. Sicha for Tu B'Shvat. So you know, Tu B'Shvat is a very interesting thing. We celebrated the festival of the trees, and we celebrated the fact that, you know, that the trees had a new year. What do we learn from the trees? So of course everyone knows the famous thing is that we learn from the trees that you always have to be growing. Right? That's what we take from the trees. They always have to be growing in your relationship with God, in your connection to God. You always have to be growing. So there is a very simple question. The 15th of the month, which most Jewish holidays come out on the 15th of the month, is when the moon is full. The moon is full is the Jewish people correspond to the moon, right? The Gentiles of the world correspond to the sun, the Jewish people correspond to the moon. The moon is full is when we reach shleimus, when we reach completion. So the Rebbe says, so it's like an oxymoron. The 15th of the month, the moon is full, as we celebrate the fact that what? That you always have to be growing. In other words, when do you know that you've reached completion? When you feel like you always have to be growing. Then you know you've reached completion. But how does that make sense? So listen. The Rebbe says an unbelievable thing. God is infinite. We're finite. How do you know that you're tapping into the infinite? You can never be a vessel for the infinite. That's a contradiction in terms, until Mashiach comes. I want to connect to God, I'm finite, God is infinite. How do I become a vessel for that? So the Rebbe says, always trying to go out of your limitations shows that you're tapping into the infinite. In other words, you can't be infinite. But the fact that the finite is connecting with the infinite is when that finite being is never content to remain within its limitations. That shows that the infinite is penetrating the finite. That shows, that's the manifestation of infinity with infinitude, is if you're always trying to grow. If you're always trying to grow, that means that within the confines of my finite reality, there's somehow the infinite light of Hashem is trying to penetrate, it's trying to get in, and it's succeeding, because I'm always wanting to grow. And that's the deeper meaning of what Rav Nachman is saying. The same thing, if I'm looking for Hashem, if I feel content, yeah, okay, I'm connected to God, I have a relationship with God, you're finite. That means you're not tapping into the infinite. But if you're a person that's always saying, I'm frustrated because I don't feel Hashem enough. I'm always trying to feel God more. I'm always trying to make Him more part of my life. I'm always trying to be aware of Him more during the course of the day. I'm always trying to make my davening even better. Where is God? That's makom kvoidei. That means that the infinity is penetrating into you. That means that the infinity is starting to shine. The infinite light is shining within your heart and mind. And therefore you're always saying, I want God, I want to get closer to Him. And therefore you understand that that's the mystery of the world is the same thing. When I look at the world and I see that mystery and I match look at the world and I'm amazed by the world. I'm amazed when I see the beauty of the world. That's a sparkling of the infinite shining within. That's the Ayei Mokum Kvoidei. That's the Ayei. I see the world and I say, Ayei, I feel that infinite light shining in because I can't explain it. The not being able to explain, you know, it always makes me laugh. You know, the scientists, they come along, the scientists, and they can, we could explain everything. Thunder, that's not God. That's, you know, electromagnetic blah, blah, blah. You know, whatever, right? You know, or you know, plants growing, that's not God. It's photosynthesis and pigments and chvesnishvas and molecules and stuff. And like, you just, you know, you smile and you're like, okay, you explained it now, right? Because it's electromagnetic whatever, right? And you put a couple of scientific words and you explain the processes and whatever, and now you're not asking Aye, because you know exactly which chemical reactions are happening. Shkoyach. What about the Aye? Where'd those come from? You know, Mark Twain said that nature is God's pen name, right? Or going back to what we began today, Elokim, the name of God Elokim, is Gematria, is the same numerical value of Ateva. Aye mokum kvoide. When I see that infinite, when I see that inexplicable, that is the Aye, that is the infinite shining into my life. And I revel in that and I enjoy that because when I'm able to say Aye, wow, this is amazing. That means that the infinite is touching my heart and mind. And then like Robert Louis Stevenson said, then I could see the pilot smiling at me and bring confidence and joy into my life. May we zeichet to see Hashem smiling at us tonight in an open way. A World Within. Yeah. Yeah.